Ladies, let's go. Source 1 on sheet 45. Sheet 45. We are dealing with the final installment on Midrash Haggadah, and I want to make sure that you have a full complement of all of the essays and bits and pieces that not all of them, obviously there's a lot more to read than this, but you have at least something to start off with. There are some good books. I meant to bring it in. There is a very good book that I recommend by someone called Simi Peters. Simi Peters is a teacher in Nishmat and various other places. She's a good friend of mine, and she is a she wrote a book on how to learn Midrash. It's called How to Learn Midrash, I think, by Simi, S-I-M-I, Peters, P-E-T-E-R-S. That's a good book. There are lots of academic books on Midrash. It's an interesting subject people study in Jewish studies courses in university, but they're not always particularly religiously focused, obviously, because they're academics, and therefore, while some of them are of interest in some places, to find sort of very authentically Jewishly, sort of religiously focused svarim on how to learn Midrash is a difficult thing to do. So, Simi Peters' book is a good one to go on with, and there are various essays here that I think you need to know. First of all, let's look at this issue as to what extent does a garita interface with halacha? And this is a very interesting shaila, because there are halachic shailas that come up where you can find sources in a garita that seem to have an impact. Let me give you an example that I didn't put on my sheet. I've been involved occasionally over the last decade or so in a shaila that came up with a number of people who were born from a surrogate mother, three triplets actually that were born in London some years ago from a surrogate mother, and it's a classic situation. They had genetic material from the Jewish mother, from the Jewish father, so her egg, his sperm, they created embryos and they implanted them in the womb of a non-Jewish surrogate mother who carried them, bore them. You'll know who these people are. It was a very public case. It's not a private, I'm not going to mention names specifically, but it was a well-known case. And these boys were born and been given back to their, if you like, the genetic parents, my friends, the Jewish parents, and they were raised. And the question, of course, is, are the babies halachically Jewish from birth? They obviously can convert, but do they need to convert? Are they Kohenim? The father's a Kohen in this case. Who is the halachic mother? Is it the birth mother? Is it the genetic mother? And where do you find Makoros on that? Now, there are many, many Makoros brought on this surrogacy issue, but one of the Makoros which is suggested is the following. Leah had many, many boys until she finally had a girl, Dinah. Dinah was the seventh child that Leah had. And when she has Leah, she calls her Dinah, but unusually, she does not give a reason for the name. Whenever she gives a name to a child, Reuben, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, etc., Yisachar, Zvulun, she gives a reason for the name. I call the baby this because God will hear me, see me, whatever it is. Dinah, she just calls her Dinah. What does Dinah mean? Justice. Judgment. Why would you call a kid justice or judgment? So there is quite a well-known Targum Yonason on the Chumash that says, why did she call her baby justice? Because it says the following. And he brings a midrash that at the time that Leah was pregnant with this baby, a little girl, okay, originally she had a boy, another boy inside her. And Rachel was pregnant with the little girl. And she prayed to God that she didn't want to have another boy, which would mean that Rachel would only have one of the tribes maximum, because the Shechaot had already had two each, Bilhar and Zilpah had already had two each. So if Leah has seven and they have two each, that's 11. There's only one left for Rachel to have. She said, I don't want her to have the girl. I don't want to have the boy. I want to have the little girl. I want her to have the boy. And says the Medrash, God switched the embryos in the womb so that Yosef was now in Rachel's womb and Dina was now in Leah's womb. So when Dina was born, Leah looked at it and said, oh, Dina, this is a just result. Leah has the boy, I have the girl. Now, if you go with that Medrash, and you're trying to work out who is the halachic mother in a surrogacy case, the genetic conception mother, or the birth surrogate mother, this source would seem to indicate who, birth or genetic?
Birth.
They're the birth mother. That from now on, whenever we ask you, who is Yosef's mother, you're not going to turn around and say, well, I mean, usually, originally it was Leah, but now it's... No, you'll say Yosef's mother is Rachel. Finished. And therefore, if this source is a good source, this will have an impact on the shiloh that they had, and it will determine whether the children were born Jewish or not born Jewish. So the shiloh then we have on a macro level is, so can you use a source like this? Is this a good source, or is this not a good source? in halacha. And we'll see in a minute what we different people have to say about this. But just so you don't, so you realize that these things do come up on a shayla halacha lemaisa level, we'll have a look at these sources. Ah, I'm not going to tell you that. Because that's a whole share in and of itself as to what was the answer. I was there when they were born. I was involved in their bar mitzvah, the shayla of their bar mitzvah, and now they're your age, basically. Have a look in number one. If you want the background to that case, I'll give it as a separate share. Number one, Rabbi Zera b'shem Shmuel says the following: Ein moirin, you can't learn halacha psak. You can't give horah. Loinin ha-halachas. Halachas are like mishnayas, like straightforward halachas psukas. You can't just go straight to mishnayas and give halachic psak. The loinin ha-agadas, and you can't pass it from agada. The loinin ha-tosafos, elamin ha-talmud. You can't go to mishnas or sefer and midrash. You have to go to the talmud. The only place you can get halacha from is Gemara. Why? Why can't you get halacha from agadas? Why can't you get halacha from these other things? Oh, true. It is in. But Talmud here, they mean the halachic sugyas in Talmud. If you look in here in the Tosfos Yontzif, you have an interesting debate. Says the Tosfos Yontzif, Ach ata, shavti ra'isi, she'ein lemeidim halacha mi-midrash rabbas. You can't go to the Midrash Rabbah and learn halacha. Straightforward seems to be exactly what the Yerushalmi was saying in number one. But the Rabbi Kiva Eger, on the spot there, he disagrees with him. Rabbi Kiva Eger says, not so straightforward. He quotes him, ein lemeidim halacha mi-midrash rabbas. He says, a pre chodosh, the Sefer Maim Chaim. He says, there are people who disagree with this, he says. The hach klala raki inyan psak halacha kedivre mi, that's only in terms of trying to pass and who to follow, hecha the loy mefurish b'shas ha'ilchasa. Meaning, if there's a discussion in the shas, and it's not clear which way we pass again, you can't bring midrashim to try and work out the answer to a sugi which is discussed in the Gemara. Nadeep, are you with us?
Yeah.
We're thinking about things again. I can see that.
Sorry.
Okay. I'm not used to people thinking in my class. Aval. Dina delays parish b'shas. But what about a halacha that's not mentioned in the shas? Says Rabbi Kiva Eger Matzinu, kama pamim? The lemeidim of midrash. He says, it's not so straightforward to say we don't learn from midrash. If the shas doesn't deal with a question, let's say my surrogacy question, which, let's say, is not discussed directly in the Gemara. So if the answer lies in the Midrash, maybe you can bring the Midrash as Rabbi Kiva Eger. And we'll see an example of that in a couple of minutes. By the way, on my surrogacy question, it is actually dealt with in the Shas. There are sources. There is a fascinating Mishnah, and actually it's Brisa brought that as well, in Yevamos, that deals with the case of a pregnant woman who converts to Judaism carrying two twins, and the twins grow up, get married, and one of them dies. Is the other twin a brother for the purpose of Hilchus Yibum, Chalitza, etc.? Or do we say that they're converts and they're not related? Or do we say that they're brothers because they're born from a Jewish mother? And the Gemara really debates there the issue of, you know, who is the mother? Is it the birth mother? Is it the genetic mother? And therefore there are sugis and shas that deal with it without having to come onto it. Very cool. It's very cool. By analogy, there's also the famous Gemara that I've mentioned it. You know, with the two cows. I must have mentioned them with the two cows. Okay, I'll talk about it another time. I'm not getting into that now. I've got too many other things to do. But there are Gemaras that deal with these issues. Now, let me give you an example of where we may indeed learn from a Medrash. Look at number four. Inyana Diyoma. Esther. I mean, the girl Esther. Okay? Ubechein. Avoy El Amelech. Asher Loikadas, says Esther to Mordechai, okay, I'll have to do it. I'll come to the king, even though I've not been invited, and you know and I know what happens potentially if you come to Ahasuerus without an invitation. Ukashe Avadati. If I get killed, I get killed. Meaning if he doesn't lift up his scepter and that's off with the head, that's it. Now, on a pshat level, kasha avadati means I may die because he doesn't save me. But Chazal understood it differently. Look at number five. She says, "Leik knoses kol ayudim, adashel loikadas." I'm a Rabbi Abba. What does it mean? Even though she's coming with not according to the law, I'm a Rabbi Abba. Shaloikadas haya. At this point, she was going to Achashverosh without any halachic justification. She bechol yom vayom ad achshav. Every day when she had to sleep with Achashverosh because she was in the harem, ba'ines. It was ba'ines. She was forced, she was raped, effectively. I mean, she wasn't physically raped, but when the king takes you by force into the harem and says, bring that girl up, there's nothing that can be done. But Asha, but now, Barossa, she's going to the king and initiating a relationship with the king. That's also because of Pi Chazal. She was married to who? To Mordechai. She was Mordechai's wife. So if she's Mordechai's wife, which is not according to Pshat, okay, but according to Chazal, according to the Drash, she was Mordechai's wife, she's now going to initiate a relationship with another man. That's also lahalocha, it's shishyar val yavor, al kashe avadati avadati, kashem she avadati mi beis abba, kach oyved mimcha. Just like I was taken from my parents, I have to be taken from you, because we will no longer be allowed to be together, because I will be initiating an extramarital relationship with somebody that, Achashverosh in this case. Fine.
That night, like, he goes and reads from his sefer, and he's clearly alone in bed. He has a whole party that night, Achashverosh. He can't sleep, and so he has to bring
Yes, because in the end, she doesn't know what it'll take in order to persuade the king to do what she wants to persuade him to do. And she goes to approach the king with, like, everything on the agenda. In the end, what happens is she sees her and he says, what do you want? And she comes up with this whole plan, like, let's make a party in order to try and get the king jealous that he thinks that she's having an affair with Haman. That's the whole thing there. But she's prepared to do whatever it takes to do in order to save the life of the Jews. So what's with this tumor of the Nadav Yehuda? Did you get the case in number 6? What was the case? Yes. Right, she did a deal with a guy that captured them all, that took them all, kidnapped them all. If she sleeps with him, he'll let them free. And what happened? Did she sleep with him?
Yeah.
Yes. And did he let them free?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did she do the right thing?
Yeah.
So, the note of Yehuda brings a tshuva from someone else that says, yes, she did the right thing. Who's what's it based on? Esther. Based on this midrash. According to the Midrash in Esther, she was married to Mordechai, and she kasha avadati avadati means, she's allowed to sleep with Achashverosh in order to save the Jewish people. So, even though you're not allowed to commit sexual immorality, even to save a life, maybe to save multiple lives, you are. Learn from Esther. And what does the Nadav Yehuda say? But not just a group of people. Certainly not for a yachid, there's nothing to say. He said, even for a group of people, maybe not. For Klal Yisrael. If you're going to save Klal Yisrael, maybe you can do this. But this is not the same case of saving Klal Yisrael.
What's backwards?
Why? What's backwards?
Well, there's still an Avera to not
save. But maybe it's not an Avera.
What is an Avera? I mean,
well, then maybe, first of all, you should just know, although we don't get into it here, there is a concept of something called an Avera Lishma. What does that mean and how does that work? Is a really interesting. Cat, I think, has a share on this. No?
I mean, he spoke about
something. What he was? Spoke about what?
His mild tears. He said, like, if you're like, how to, like, cure it. Like, something like that. He's never said specific. It's an Avera Lishma, but if it's, like, kind of for a thing of her.
Okay, I don't think that. I mean, cure is a whole
thing.
Right. There is such a thing as a Avera Lishma. The classic example of Avera Lishma is not Hester, but who is it?
Yael.
When Yael sleeps with Sisera...
She doesn't.
What?
This happened to us in Sukkot, that someone said to us that she does, and we didn't believe that it was so, and we looked up all the Midrashim, and one person says that she slept with him, and the rest of the Midrashim emphatically disagree and say she did not, she gave him no.
The Gemara says...
No, everyone else is emphatic. Rashi disagrees, no, who is it? Rambam disagrees, who is it? Even Ezra disagrees, they all say she didn't sleep with him.
The Gemara says she slept with him.
Yeah, but everyone else says she didn't.
No, I'll peep shot. She didn't. Al-Pipshat, she gave him milk. He was tired, and he fell asleep, and then she put a tent peg through his head. Al-Pichazal...
Ezra goes on a whole one-page rant about how you should never, ever accuse her of such harm. harlotry and she would never do such a thing, and she gave him milk.
Okay, so I'm glad that you looked into it in detail. According to the Gemara, I think it's the Gemara in Megillah, no? That she slept with him, and the Gemara asks, how could she sleep with him when she's chaver akeni, when she's married to already somebody else, or married to someone else? And the answer is, it's aveir lishma. And the Gemara gets into a whole discussion there about aveir lishma. How could she have an extramarital relationship to save Klal Yisrael? And it's part of this whole discussion. It seems, if you read Shirat Dvorah, it sounds pretty explicit that Deborah is describing the fact that she slept with
him. They reference that, and one of them, a freshman, I don't remember who, goes on with this whole very long thing about how in Shoftim, it never, ever, ever, ever keeps from telling us about the terrible sexual immoral things that people do, and how it tells us about rape and pillaging and all these things. And so why wouldn't it tell us if Yael slept with him?
Okay.
Why would it try and keep it?
Okay, I agree. I'm not trying to prove that that's, you know, mukhrach, that it has to be seen that way. It's very interesting to get. Anyway, I brought you at the end here, based on this midrash, well, what does that have lemaisa? So Esther, you know, could she or couldn't she to save the Jewish people? Can you learn? So the shaila came up from Ari Schwartz, who I brought you once before in an article that you didn't like much. It was that article on Hashkofa and Zionism and things like that. But Rav Ari Schwartz is a very interesting person. He caused headlines back in 2010 when he published a tshuva about this issue. It's actually I think he related to Tzipi Livni. Tzipi Livni, of course, is very involved in the election. She's, you know, she might be the next prime minister of Israel at some stage. We'll talk more about that in the election discussion that we're going to have. It's funny because this is being recorded, and by the time anyone listens to this, they'll know full well whether she is or she isn't. So it's like a time warp in a sense. But Tzipi Livni was, I think, originally a spy. And they asked her at one stage, I think it was her, whether she was ever required to do anything sexually compromising in order to get information. And she was, no, never would ever ask this kind of thing. But that's a good question. If a female spy is asked, who's married, is that they say to her, look, you've got to sleep with this guy, he's got information about the Iranian nuclear program. This information could give us the ability to destroy the Iranian bomb. And is she or is she not allowed Halacha to do that in order to get that information which would save Klal Yisrael. And this is he has a whole analysis based on Esther and the Tshuva.
Wait, if she's not married though?
If she's not married, it's a different Shiloh. It's still a Shiloh. But it's not.
If she's not married, is she ever allowed to get married though after that?
Well, why would she not be able to get married after that? If a woman has, let's say it is an extramarital
affair.
No, and a woman who has an extramarital affair, even though it's a terrible availer, there's no halacha that she can never get married afterwards. She can't marry the husband, or she can't marry the guy she had an affair with. She can marry someone else.
So she has to divorce her
husband. Yeah. So the shaila here is, does she have to divorce her husband? Did Esther have to divorce Mordechai? And this whole halacha based on the Medrash comes into play here. I'm not getting into the details of what he said in that tshuva, but you can hear the shaila. You know, as more and more religious people are involved in the Israeli armed forces, I can hear a spy at some stage having a question, having a shaila, and calling up a rav and saying, look, I'm a spy. I can't tell you who I am, but I'm a spy.
No, I read an article on our show a few months ago that they hired a special rabbi for the Mossad because they're more and more religious agents.
That's really interesting. Look, I've had shailas addressed to me that have been sent anonymously through Gmail addresses that have been made up, created for the purposes of the shaila, because they don't want me to know who they are, and they've created a Gmail address. The shaila didn't seem to have anything to do with spying, but but I'm saying that you could ask an anonymous shaila, and it may be appropriate to do that in certain circumstances. Anyway, that's a different question. I'm not getting into that particular shaila right now. Let's go over to page 2. Now, the bits of trees that I've killed en masse in order to give you the information, I've given you the following articles. Make sure that you know what I've given you and that you understand what I've given you. The classic article on this issue is the Rambam's piece in the Hagdamah to Perichelek, which we're going to run through right now, where the Rambam goes through the different groups of people. I brought you that in English. I brought you that in English because the original is in Arabic, and there's no reason for you to struggle with the original or even necessarily to read it in Hebrew. Your English is fine. It's a decent translation. I've also given you just now, I gave it out to you, I think, already, the introduction to the Agadah by Rav Avram ben HaRambam. The Rambam's son, Avram ben HaRambam, this is an English translation of a very important essay which appears, if you want to ever read the essay, it appears in the Hagdama to the Ein Yaakov. The Ein Yaakov is the is a classic Perush collection and Perush on the Agadotis of the Gemara. And there the Rambam goes through, the son of the Rambam goes through his father's positions and his positions on readings of Agadot. As you will know, the Rambam himself was very controversial. We're going to talk a lot more about the Rambam when we get into his whole life and approach and works and his work in Halacha and all that kind of stuff and philosophy. We're going to see him, Be'ezrat Hashem, just after the Pesach break. But there was a lot of controversy. Controversy. I don't know what you say anymore. I don't know what I say anymore. There was a lot of very controversial things said about the Rambam after he died. And Rav Avraham ben Arambam had a lot of defending of his father to do. And this is a very important essay on Agadotas, as to how to read Agadotas, whether you read them literally, not literally. I'm not going to go through that now, but make sure that you know that that's there. The third thing I gave you that I'm not going to go through right now is this essay on the Agadotas by Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzarto, the Ramchal. This appears at the back of this book that I mentioned last time, The Juggler and the King. It's an English translation of that essay, and I'll refer to this book in a minute. That is also a very important essay on literal and non-literal meaning of Agadotas. And the other things that I gave you were the shorter modern articles, the ones from Rav Heschel and the Rav Feldman's introduction to the book. Now, this is something that you're going to come across, because there are a lot of people who feel, for whatever reason, that you have to take Agadotas in a literal way. And if you don't, somehow you're mezalzel in Chazal. And this is an argument that I've had with teachers in schools, not this school, in other schools, where they insist on teaching the girls that, you know, you have to take Agadotas literally, otherwise it's wrong, etc., etc. This is just not the approach of so many of the key people who have taught how to learn Agadotas. And Rabbi Feldman did a wonderful service for the Jewish people a long time ago now. This book is 1990. I don't think anyone in this room, apart from me, was born in 1990. I remember buying it just after my wedding, which was 1991. He goes through a number of the really strange, weird Agadotas in the Gemara, okay? And he brings an adaptation of the Vilna Gaon's Perush. The Vilna Gaon has, he gives it the back, the actual Perush of the Vilna Gaon, in case you want to look at it. But some of these Agadotas are very strange. Let me read you a couple, okay? Said Rabbi Bar Bar Chana, this is an Agadotah from Baba Basra. There's a Rabbi Bar Bar Chana story in Baba Basra. Let's read it out. Says Rabbi Bar Bar Chana, I saw Chormin, the son of Lilith, running along the battlements of the city walls of Mechuzah. A cavalryman below, riding on an animal, couldn't keep up with him. Once two mules were saddled for Chormin and stood on two sides of the river Donag. He jumped from one mule to the other while holding two cups of wine in his hands, pouring from one to the other without a drop falling to the earth. That was the day when things, quotes, rise to the heavens and descend to the depths, unquotes. Finally, the king's men heard of Horman's doing and put him to death. Okay, end of Agadotah. What would you do with an Agadotah like that? How do you understand an Agadotah like that? Is it meant to be a literal Agadotah? Let me read you another one. Said Rabbi Bar Bar Chana, once I saw a frog that was as big as the city of Hegronia. And how big is the city of Hegronia? 60 houses. A serpent came and swallowed the frog. Then a raven came and swallowed the serpent. It flew up and sat on a tree. Consider how strong the tree was, said Rav Papa Bar Shmuel. Had I not been there myself, I would never have believed it. Like, there are Agadotas of this nature that one has to somehow get a handle on. How does that work? How do they work? There are Agadotas that seem very shocking. The Gemara in Sanhedrin. Says that there's one in Sanhedrin. Where is this Gemara? In Yevamos. There's a Gemara in Yevamos that says when Adam Arishon was created, he didn't have a wife. He was on his own. So all the animals came to him, says the Gemara, the Medrash, that he had sexual relations with each one of the animals, one after the other, to see which would be the suitable mate for him. And he found that he didn't have a suitable mate. And that God's Baruch Hu said, oh, so you can't find a mate in the animal world. Here's the Chava. The Chava is going to be the real mate. You're like, what do you do with that? Are you really telling me that there's any kind of approach that is going to take that literally, which is legitimate on any level? You're going to say that? How does one understand these Agadotas? Yes?
We're with the rabbis, is it possible, it wasn't real, but for them, they experienced it like either in a dream or like
hallucination. So we'll see that. That is one approach, and we'll see that in the Rabbeinu Chananel on the story of the Beis HaMedrash. That's that what you're saying from that story? Because we'll see that's one of the sources on the sheet. We'll get to that in a minute. For now, let's look at the Rambam. Look at the Rambam, please.
The Rambam three, the three groups of people that we talked about. Let me just find my Rambam. I have it right here. Excuse me. So many bits of paper. Question of where they all are. Here it is, right in front of me. Have you got it, girls? I wanted to show you this because this is really critical and very foundational. You must know, this is from the Rambam's introduction to Perek Chelek. The Rambam wrote three very important introductions in his Perush on the Mishnah. The Rambam wrote the Perush on the Mishnah when he was a young man. He wrote, as part of that Perush on the Mishnah, three very important introductions. What are they? Do you know them? What's that? Chelek, which is his introduction when he says, Kol Yisrael Yeshem Chelek Olam Haba. He says, I need to write you an introduction on what is Olam Haba, what is not Olam Haba, what is Kareis, what is not, what is Mashiach, and all that kind of stuff. So he's a very, and there he puts out, sets out his 13 Ikrim. If you want to know where the 13 Ikrim are, there in the introduction to Perek Chelek. Another one is what we call the Shmona Prakim. You heard of the Shmona Prakim?
Yeah.
That's his introduction to what?
Birkei
Avos, where he sets out his ethics and philosophy on ethics, etc. And the other is the general hakdama to the whole Perush HaMishnah, which we've seen many times in this particular series, which is where he talks about Torah Shebal Peh. Fine. Have a look here. Look, eyes down, please. The Rambam says as follows. You must know that the words of the sages are differently interpreted by three groups of people. So, okay, let's divide up these groups. Who's going to be the first group? Who's going to read? Yes, Esther. You with us? Come on, girls. Let's get it together. Not that. The Rambam. The Rambam. It starts, it says, other writings, Chelek Sanhedrin. Not that one. Oh, you don't have it. You do have it. You for sure have it. Because I for sure gave it to you. And let me just see if I have another one. Tucked away here. Just one second. I might just have another one. A secret little copy. Uno momento. Yes, Nediva, would you like one? If I said Nediva, Adina, you found it? I thought so. Okay, fine. So let's have a look. Who's reading now? Esther, let's go. The first group is the largest one.
The first group is the largest one. I observed them as I both heard about them. They accept the teachings of the sages in their simple literal sense. And do not think about these teachings, and do not think that these teachings contain any human meaning at all.
Just one second. Pause while I give a copy to someone else.
I don't have that.
Oh, what is this, girls?
Yeah, most of them.
You for sure have one because I gave one to you last time.
Me?
Yeah, you.
Well,
can you share with Rina? Rina, you have one, right?
Yes.
So you share with Rina for a second.
It's not the problem of polarity.
No, it is not the problem of polarity.
Yeah, no, I didn't get one.
Now, let's go. Fine. Shh. Everyone with me? So, they don't think these teachings have any hidden meanings at all. Esther, a bit louder.
And
this is more important this bit now, say this bit louder.
They understand the teachings of the sages only in their literal sense, in spite of the fact that some of the teachings, when taken literally, seem so fantastic and irrational that if one were to repeat them literally, even to the uneducated, let alone the sophisticated scholars, their amazement would prompt them to ask how anyone in the world could believe such things true, much less
edify, meaning, how can you tell me this is ethical character building religiously important when it seems to be nonsense? It's irrational. If you're telling me that there was a frog as big as the city of Hegronia and it was swallowed by a serpent, which was swallowed by a bird, which sat on a tree, are you telling me that that's literal? That people will reject Judaism, says Rambam, if this is how you teach it. Yes.
Does that mean that this applies for all of them?
My Masorah is that the presumption, the default position with the Gadita has to be like this. We will see that the Rambam...
But
it's not literal. The default position with psukim in the Torah is that it is literal.
But we don't always take psukim literally either. Meaning, when it comes to the Torah often says things, and we say, that's not what it literally means. Many times.
Ayin
tachat ayin. In terms of halacha, the yad chazakah v'zeroa netuya. We know that's not what it literally means. But our presumption when it comes to Chumash is that it is literal until there's a reason to say not. Our presumption when it comes to Midrash is that it is not literal, but we'll see in the Rambam himself that he's some Midrash and he said, well, literal historical accounts.
Right, so
doesn't mean that no Midrash is ever literal.
No, I was going to ask about the Kishana
Ish. Yeah, so clearly that he says that.
That could be literal.
Yes, absolutely. And the Rambam says definitely it's literal, and he says not only that, but he says he found that in other historical sources. That this is something that Avram experienced. But there's nothing fantastical or irrational about that Midrash. Okay, it talks about a nais. We're not denying the possibility of nais. Nais is something that we understand and believe
so
in completely.
All those things that you're saying are fantastical or irrational or whatever could all just be put under the category of nais.
No, that's not true. No. There's a very big difference between Avram had a political fight with the king of Nimrod, and he threw him in a furnace, and miraculously he was able to get out of the furnace alive. There's a difference between that and something that says, I saw a frog as big as the city of New York, and it was swallowed by a bird, which was swallowed. You see, there's a difference between those two things. That's not nais. That's just like, it's like a fairy tale. But says the Rambam, if you present it in a literal way, people will only take it as a fairy tale. People will reject it. And it's not meant to be. It's for sure, chas v'shalom, it's not a fairy tale. The Rambam says it's a very deep, deep, deep idea of hashgacha and philosophy. Carry on, please. The members of this group.
Do you want me to continue?
Yeah, just a little bit more.
Sure. The members of this group are poor in knowledge. One can only regret their folly.
So he says nebach, this group. Mm-hmm. It's like nebach. They think they're taking it seriously, but they're actually not taking it seriously. Carry on.
Their very effort to honor and to exalt the sages in accordance with their own meager understanding actually humiliates them.
They think they're being very frum, saying Chazal said this, you have to believe Chazal. Actually, they're bringing down Chazal, says the Rambam. This is quite controversial. Not everybody liked the Rambam when he said this, but carry on.
As God lives, this group destroys the glory of the Torah and extinguishes its light, so they make the Torah of God.
Okay, so go over the page. So he's saying, in other words, you have to take Midrash seriously. If you take it literally, you're not taking it seriously. Because people will not take it seriously if it's literal. Just read the first few lines of the next page from 408 there.
The worst offenders?
Yeah, the worst offenders.
The worst offenders are preachers who preach and expound the masses, but they themselves don't understand.
So he says people who stand up and give droshes can sometimes be the worst offenders. Don't believe things just because people stand up and say them in public. It doesn't mean that they're right.
With that they keep silent about what they do not know, as it is written. If only they would be utterly silent, it would be accounted to them as wisdom. Or they might at least say, we do not understand what our sages intended in the statement, and we do not know how to explain it.
So the Rambam, don't be scared to say, I don't understand this. People who insist on explaining things when they don't really know what they mean, but they have to explain it because there has to be an answer, that's not good. As a methodology, that's not good. Better to turn around and say, I just answer your question. Do you respect a rabbi that stands up and says, I don't understand this? I think the answer is yes. I mean, do you respect a rabbi that says that about everything he ever reads?
No.
Meaning, there comes a point when I don't understand this can't be the constant response. But from now on, who understands everything? Now, that's the first group. And there's lots of people in this group. I know personal colleagues that have stood up and give shiurim in places where they've got into such hot water. People have got, they want to put them in chirim and then this and then that, because they're not taking midrashim literally. You wouldn't believe what a hot topic this is for some people, that they feel if you're not taking it literally, you're denigrating Chazal. So the Rambam, I'm sorry, that group of people is just poor in understanding. They think they're doing the right thing, but they're not. The second group. Now, who's reading? Joy.
The second group is also a numerous one. It too consists of persons who, having read or heard the words of the sages, understand them according to their simple literal sense, and believe that the sages intended nothing else than what may be learned from their little interpretation. Inevitably, they ultimately declare the sages to be fools, hold them up to contempt, and slander what does not deserve to be slandered.
This group is even worse. These people are apikorsim, basically. Right. They say that the Chazal are just writing fables. And you get these books of, like, the books of fables or legends of the rabbis. And that. When at the end of the day, it's like folklore. Mm-hmm. Like Aesop's fables or something like that. Mm-hmm. He says, there's the Rambam. These people also take it literally, but they're making fun of the rabbis. That, see, the first group at least were trying to do it, you know, for Kovod HaTorah, even though they were misled. This group are just people trying to be Mazalzel. He says they just think that they're cleverer than everybody else. They don't realize. I remember once that a fellow that I actually, you know, respected in many ways. He was an intelligent man, but he was one of the people that I met when I was at university. He stood up one Friday, a senior person, like an older person, and he stood up and said, it wasn't a rabbi, it was a community member, and said that I object to saying, Nar Hayiti, Vagam Zaganti, Valora Iti Tzadik Neza, Vazarwa Vakesh Lachem. He says, I won't say that, because it's wrong. Why is it wrong? He says, because. What are you saying? That you've never seen a righteous person abandoned with his children and all? He says, that's just not correct. Anyone who wrote that obviously is just ridiculous. So you feel like saying to the guy, like, don't you think that the rabbis who wrote that knew that? Do you think that they really felt that every person in the world who was a tzaddik always had a wonderful life? Have you not read the book of Yov? Have you not read all the analysis on this and the discussion on this? Like, why do you think that you're more intelligent than the people who wrote this? Like, what kind of chutzpah is that? You won't say because you've realized that they were just silly. There are so many people in the world like this. And you know, it's upsetting to hear this, but that's what you see. Yes. The first groups of people take it literally and they say that that's what Chazal meant and you have to try and work out because Chazal were geniuses and you can't twist what they said, you have to take it how they said it. The second group says that Chazal said it because it was all silly and it's just legends and fables and whatever. Now the third group, let's get to the third group because I've got a lot of other things to do. Oh, am I? Oh, so read that one. Where is it?
The members of the... Okay, they imagine their own intelligences of a higher order than that of sages, and that the sages were so simpletons who suffered from inferior intelligence. The members of this group were so pretentiously stupid that they could never attain genuine wisdom.
Oh, you like that sentence. The last one says, they are more stupid than the first group, and many of them are simply fools. This is an accursed group, because they attempt to refute men of established greatness whose wisdom is demonstrated, etc. Now, the third group. Who's reading the third group? Yes, Adina. From the bottom, there is a third group.
If members are so few in number that it's hardly appropriate to call them a group, except in the sense in which one speaks that the sun is as a group or species, of which it is the only member.
The Rambam says there's a third group which is so small that there's actually pretty much only one person in it. Right. But yeah, he says that there are a few people in it, but he says these are the people who really understand. Carry on.
This group consists of men who the greatness of our thesis is clear. They recognize the superiority of their intelligence from their words, which point to exceedingly profound truths. Even though the third group is few and scatter, their books teach the perfection which was achieved by the authors in the high level of truth which they have achieved.
Meaning they really take Chazal seriously. And because they take Chazal seriously, they want to try and understand it in the most serious way, which is a non-literal way. Carry on.
The members of this group understand that the sages knew as clearly as we do the difference between the impossibility of the impossible and the existence of that which must exist. They know what the sages do not speak nonsense. They know that the sages do not speak nonsense, and it is clear to them that the words of the sages contain both an obvious and hidden meaning. Thus, whenever the sages spoke of the things that seem impossible, they were employing the style of riddle and parable, which was the method of truly speaking.
Oh, and he goes on to say, whenever you see a midrash which is clearly impossible, for whatever reason, they're obviously talking in riddle and parable. Now, therefore, there are different kinds of midrash, and as Nadeva quite correctly pointed out, it was on the sheet, which I'm not going to go through in detail now, but just to refer back to it, source number 8 on my sheet, where the Rambam goes and he talks about Avram in the furnace, Nimrod, he says that you'll find this as a historical account. He says at the end, this is their account, which you'll find clearly stated in the book called The Nabataean Agriculture. Not a book that I'm used to reading at bedtime, but he says, you know, nothing is said there of the account given in our trustworthy books, none of them mention it by way of prophecy, for whatever it says, that, you know, you see various different things written in other places, and it's a serious midrash which we don't take in an allegorical way. But many midrashim, he says clearly, we do. Just let me read you a couple of other lines. All students of rhetoric know the real concern of a riddle is with its hidden meaning and not with its obvious meaning. Clear. The next paragraph. It is often difficult for us to interpret words and deduce their true meaning from the form in which they are contained, so that their true inner meaning conforms to reason and corresponds to the truth. And you can go on and read more about that, which I'm not going to do now because we don't have time. So just look at the last page. Just go over the page for a second. He gives various examples of things which may be like that. He says even in Tanakh itself, he says the dead bones of Ezekiel, of Yechezkel, were considered by one of the rabbis to be only metaphorical. It's not really a body of dead bones, a valley of dead bones. He talks about Sefer Iyov. And then he says at the end, though, but if you belong to the third group, When you encounter a word of the sages that seems to conflict with reason, you will pause, consider it, and realize that this utterance must be a riddle or a parable. And that's how you will interpret it. Go back to my sheet, please. We've got 10 minutes, and I want to do a couple of other things with you.
He literally says, if you hate this book, and it makes you uncomfortable, it means you're a fool.
Yeah. Because who do you think is more intelligent? You or Chazal? It's like getting on a 747, Boeing 747, and say, this is ridiculous. They obviously haven't built this plane, right? Like, and you know about aviation or not? You know? I brought you this interesting article from Rabbi Adlerstein, which I'm not going to read. Do you know about Rabbi Adlerstein? Rabbi Adlerstein lives in Los Angeles. He's a very important educator there. He teaches in a number of institutions there. And he writes a great blog called Cross Currents. If you want a good blog, Cross Currents is a very interesting blog with lots of it's a very thought through, thinking sort of more Haredi American position, but it's very thought through and very intelligently put together. And he speaks about this as well. He's very into the Maharal, and he talks about the Maharal's position on this too. I brought you in number 9, a fascinating piece where he talks about where the Rabbeinu Hananel talks about the Gemara there with Rabbi Shum, Rabbi Leza in the base Medrash, you know, and the Tanosh Achnai. So what does Rabbeinu Hananel say, number 9? What does he say could be, you could say? How can you interpret it? There was a dream that one of the Rabbonim in the Beit HaMedrash fell asleep, and he had this dream, because they didn't have Nevuah. They weren't Nevi'im. But the dreams of a person could have an element of Nevuah, especially in Chazal, of the Tanaim. So he had this dream, and he said, look, I dreamed of Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Lezer in the Beit HaMedrash, and they were arguing, and it's like there was a river flowing backwards, and there was a tree moving, and Chazal recorded it, this dream, even though at the end he says there, you don't hold by dreams, and therefore they went after the majority, after Rabbi Mahatoy. So I'm going to pascalize this guy's dream. We don't do that. But they wanted the dream to be there, because who knows? Maybe this is an element of Nevuah.
Why did they excommunicate him?
No, that was Rabbi Lezer. Oh, in the dream they excommunicated. Ah, so you're saying why did they? Because in real life they actually also excommunicated
him. So why did they excommunicate someone?
That's a good shot.
That's a good question.
Yeah, it could be that there are other reasons as well. But it sounds from the Gemara that this was the Makiv HaPatish. This was the thing that brought this up. It could be that he wouldn't accept the psak. That was it happened. He wouldn't accept the psak of Rabbi Yeshua. He wouldn't agree with Akhri Rabbim Lahatos. And that's the answer. He wouldn't go with Akhri Rabbim Lahatos for whatever reason he had. Maybe because of the Shita in MS, and he said the Rabbim are not right if they're wrong. You know, we talked about that.
But then we always talk about that appointment is very much such a terrible thing, and it's just like, it comes as a sign that, you know, someone who embarrasses his friend in public, it's like he's killing someone.
Okay.
But they had total right to put him in Chayrim because God was not on his side.
Okay, no, God was on his side.
No, but only in the dream. We know that God was on his side because God starts doing all kinds of miracles.
And you say that was in the dream. Okay,
the dream, and good. The guy
there was obviously a real argument between Rabbi Lazar and Rabbi Shura. And there was also this thing, look, he just wants to suggest that maybe it was a dream, maybe it wasn't. Whatever, you can't take these agadot as a face value. That's the key. One second, just a couple of other things. And then I want to do a little exercise. Just a couple of lines at the end of the sheet there. Look in number 11. Let's look at a couple of other... There are a lot of health warnings on a Gadata. Do not learn this unless you know what you're doing, otherwise you'll make a mess of it. Look at number 10 for a second. Abri B'shua ben Levi. Hada Gadata haksuva, ein lo chelek. Okay, if you're writing down these agadatas, that's not always a good thing. Elo chelek. I'm Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. I'm a min yomai in my whole life. Lo yistakalti b'simer d'agadata. I've never read a book of agadata in my life. El hachazman, once I did it. You know? But it's like, it's a dangerous thing. Look at number 11. Rabbi Simlai. Atagami Rabbi Yosef Yonason. Rabbi Simlai came to Rabbi Yonason. Amalei said to him, Alpan agadata, teach me some agadata. Amalei, he said to him, Maso Rabbi Yadi, I have a tradition. May I say from my fathers, Shaloi lelameda garata, I'm not going to teach a garata loy le bavloi, not to a Babylonian, but loy le drumai, not to someone who lives in the south. Shehen gasi ruach, because they're Vulcan. Umuoti Torah, and they don't have much Torah. The at, and you, Nahardai, you're a Babylonian. Vadardran, and you also live in the south. I'm not going to teach your garata. I don't teach it to people like that. Look how this translates into the halacha. Number 12. Says the Sefer Hasidim, Oid Katan, Ata Ein Megalin Agada. Don't teach agadatas to children. I wonder what he would have thought of. What would he have thought of a little medrash says? Don't don't teach agadah to tamua lekatanim. Don't teach weird agadahs to children, he says. Pen yomer, because they're going to turn around and say, ain boy mamash. That is silly. And you don't want to teach children the idea that Torah is silly. That's a great question. And from there he'll extrapolate, says Sefer Chassidim, if this is silly, then I assume everything's silly. Because it's just silly.
It's like, really bad because so some schools, they teach such a fact, and then you grow up and you realize, oh, wait a second, if this isn't actually in Chumash, then you're just like... What did you tell me that was true?
Why do we not?
Story of
life.
Now, at the end of the day, I agree with that and I don't agree with it. I agree with it in the sense of the following. When people teach Parsha at school, so Parsha includes stories and Midrashim, and everybody knows that, like, you know, this, that, and the other. And Esav, we'll see, Esav kissed Yaakov, but really he bit his neck and his neck turned to, to stone and all that kind of stuff. Now, you're going to turn around and say you shouldn't teach that to kids because then they don't know what happened in the Chumash. Now, the answer is, you're right, there have to be, but at the end of the day, there's no excuse for not knowing what's in the Psukim, because you should read them. And people who tell me, I never knew this wasn't in the Psukim, I thought it was in the Psukim, the answer is, well, you never read the Psukim, did you? If you'd have just sat down with an English Bible and read it before Shabbos for 15 minutes, you'd have known that. So, I have little sympathy for people who don't know what's in the Psukim.
Like, that's how they teach it, like,
that I agree with. So look what he says at the end here. He says, don't teach kids Midrashim, because otherwise they'll think it's silly. The chayla ame haaretz. He says people who are uneducated, shelo yaminu, they won't believe you. The chayla kol maligim aleihim, or anyone who you think is going to mock something, don't teach them that. And I just don't know why our educational system doesn't take the Sefer Chassidim on board and either learn midrashim when the kids are older. Look at number 13 for a second. So this is a chazal, not Sefer Chassidim. Although Sefer Chassidim is a great source. Look at the Chazal number 13. Ksiv, as it says, Kvasim l'ulvushecha. Okay? You close the like sheep. Okay? Kvashim. Ksiv. You can read it Kvashim. B'shasha talmidech k'tanim. When you're talmidim a small t'yem chavesh l'fneim divrei Torah, then you have to simplify divrei Torah in some way. The higdila, but once they get bigger, nasu tamid chacham, they become tamid chachamim. So he megale lehem sisrei Torah. Then you have to explain what they really mean. So there are different educational methods coming out or messages coming out here. On the one hand, you really have to be very careful how you teach small children. I wonder whether the answer is not to teach medrash at all to small children. When they're bigger, to teach it to them to say, these are the words of Chazal, and when you're bigger, we'll explain all the deeper meanings, because they're old enough to know that it's got something of a deeper meaning. And when they're big, you really do that. Or whether you should only bring the, I don't know, we'd have to turn a lot of our schools on their head. This is what they teach kids when they're 6 or 7. Yeah.
No, I'm just saying, in these specific ways, I would say, this is Midrash, this is an upper minus of that version, that's what's in the part. When you're 6 years old, then you grow up learning that. And
do you think that'll confuse people? If you never confuse people,
then they'll say,
if you're little and you say this is a medrash and this is a posuk, won't they say, well, which one is true? And then if what are you going to say to the 6-year-old?
No,
they do.
They ask questions.
They do.
The average 2-year-old asks 250 questions a day. A 4-year-old. Sorry.
Really?
Yeah.
See, if you teach the kids, this is in the pesukim, and the kids will say, well, did this really happen? And you say, of course, of course. Well, no, 1 second. Of course, the kid will say, Avraham Avinu, Yitzchak. So then you say, but this isn't a medrash. So then the kid will say, well, did that really happen? So what are you going to say? You're going to say yes, then you're in the problem. You're going to say no, so then the kid's going to say, so you're teaching us things that didn't happen? That's, why are you lying to us? Because the kid...
Or they'll grow up thinking it's fact and then realize that it's not.
So maybe... So you're going to have to find a time when the kid's educated enough. Maybe you should teach the Mishnayos when they're 6. Anyway, before we finish, girls, even if we don't do it in class, I brought you this exercise at the end where it says that Esav kissed Yaakov and his neck turned to stone and Esav's teeth broke. This is a really famous one that the kids all learn in school. And I brought you a bunch of questions, and I'm not going to go through this now, but if you really want to unlock this Midrash, it really is all about the nature of the kiss. And what is a kiss? And why is a neshek and a nishika the same word? Why is a weapon the same as a kiss? And what does that mean? And are kisses always positive, are kisses negative? And what does it mean?
You kiss people to save the Jewish nation, even if you're married.
That's not what I'm talking about, Joy. And what does he mean? What does he mean that the neck turns to stone? What is the relevance of stone being not makabel tumah? That Yaakov is able to, if you like, not be makabel the tumah of Esav. And really, what this message is all about is how do we deal as a society of religious Jews when the non-Jewish world wants to approach us in friendship? That's really what this message is all about. It's about how do we take it as being genuine? Do we accept it? Do we connect with it? And do we have, you know, communal activity and joy? Do we take it and be scared that it's going to have an agenda? How do you deal with millions of dollars of Christian fundamentalist money being poured into Birthright? That's what this Medrash is all about. Now, when you teach it to the kids and you teach them that Yaakov's neck turned to stone and the Esav's teeth fell out, that's very nice, but then I think what you need to do is at some stage you need to revisit that Medrash and you need to say, actually guys, this is a Chazal's discussion about what do we do when the non-Jews are really nice to us and how do we take that? And that's actually a much more interesting discussion to a 15-year-old. And if you can get that 15-year-old to put that really life-important idea back into the Medrash through Chazal, then I think they'll say, wow, that's really interesting. Oh yeah, that's a metaphor for Kabbalah's tumah, and the teeth is a this, and the this is a this, and the kisses are this, and the that is this. And then what they'll come out with is like a piece of Havdil of literary analysis, but they will have give a lot of chashivas to the words of Chazal. Yeah, in other words, there comes a point, but I firmly believe you can teach this to a 16-year-old. No, you don't have to wait for someone's... Yeah, this kind of more sophisticated approach, if it's an intelligent person. All right, let's leave it there.